This is not a situation, the specifics of which have been addressed by an Alaska court before.
Ongoing concerns over the election results in Northwest Arctic District 40. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the complicated history of Alaska's rail belt utility companies.
As we said in our report to the legislature, if you were starting from scratch today, you would probably have a different structure.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Legislators called on state elections officials today to delay certifying the results in a district that covers North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs. Those calls are based on concerns about how the recent primary election was handled in some precincts. But Division of Elections Director Josie Banky says a state election review board would certify the results for District 40 today, due to the closeness of the race there. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
At a Senate State Affairs Committee meeting in Anchorage, Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire said the Division of Elections should correspond with the U.S. Department of Justice about Federal Voting Rights Act concerns.
If this is certified and the person it is certified in favor of ultimately does not prevail in a future special election or a future audit, I think the impact on voter morale and confidence is devastating.
Legislators focused on three precincts. In Shugnak, in District 40, voters were allowed to vote in both the Republican primary and in the primary for all other parties, in violation of state law. In Newtok, in District 38, there was a discrepancy between the number of ballots counted and a separate tally that election officials wrote down. State officials say this was a data entry error and didn't affect the ballots. And in Shafornak, in District 38, a somewhat similar discrepancy occurred. The difference between the candidates in District 38 is too large to be affected by the precincts in question. But in District 40, a recount is likely, and any change could affect the outcome. Dean Westlake of Kotzebue was leading incumbent Representative Benjamin Nagiak of Barrow by 21 votes before the certification. Division of Elections Director Josie Banky says the division's core mandate is to ensure that every qualified voter has a meaningful opportunity to cast a ballot and have his or her vote count. In Shugnak, the election official didn't attend election training. State law doesn't penalize those who miss training.
We as a division really need to do a better job educating our voters about the two-ballot system.
Some residents who attended the meeting at the Anchorage Legislative Information Office say they're concerned about the results. Luke Wells of Barrow says he wanted to vote in the open ballot primary for Democrats and other non-Republicans, but election officials told him and other Republicans that they could only cast a question ballot in the open ballot primary.
It seemed as if the Republicans were being, the focus was on not letting them vote the open ballot in this situation.
Senate President Kevin Meyer, an Anchorage Republican, questioned whether it's appropriate to certify the results.
How do you certify an election that was not legal?
Alpheus Bullard, a lawyer for the legislature, says that if a challenge to the District 40 election results occurs, it's not clear what the outcome would be.
It's a violation of our statutes and what ballots need to be provided. I don't know whether the necessary bias is there or what a court would find. This is not a situation, the specifics of which have been addressed by an Alaska court before.
The defeated candidate, or 10 local residents, can request a recount within 5 days of the completion of the state review. It's not clear what day the review will be finalized. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
If you live in Alaska's rail belt, you might like to think electricity moves from the power plant to your light bulb in the most efficient, cheapest way possible. But because the region has six different utilities that haven't always gotten along, that might not be the case. Now, for the first time in years, the state is seriously talking about putting a kind of referee in charge of how electricity moves from point A to point B. That could lower your electric bill, but the rail belt's power companies are nervous about handing over the keys. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Harbaugh has more.
Want some tea?
Chris Rose is making tea in his apartment in downtown Anchorage. He uses an electric stove to boil the water. Pretty simple stuff. But Rose, who is executive director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, knows that how the electricity got to his stove is anything but simple.
There is a backstory to this whole miracle that we call electricity that we use all the time in our lives, but often just take for granted because all we really want is the light to go on when we flip the switch.
That backstory is especially messy in Alaska. There are six power companies in the rail belt, the region stretching from Fairbanks to Homer. That's a lot of utilities for a relatively small population, and in the past, they haven't worked together very well. Rose says that could mean we're paying more for electricity than we should.
The utilities collectively have spent more than $1.5 billion on new, mostly natural gas generation over the last 5 years. In the rail belt, some critics would say we didn't necessarily need all of that had we had regional planning.
The Regulatory Commission of Alaska keeps tabs on the grid. Chairman Bob Pickett says the rail belt grid was set up decades ago when Alaska's population was smaller and really spread out. Then it made sense for each town to have their own power company.
You know, when you look at it historically, it's not real surprising that it happened that way. As we said in our report to the legislature, if you were starting from scratch today, you would probably have a different structure.
The commission told lawmakers the rail belt power grid needs reform and maybe a kind of supervisor. That person, really a group of people, would look at the whole grid and make sure electricity moves around the region efficiently. Paul Hines, professor of electrical engineering at the University of Vermont, says some version of this is pretty common in the lower 48.
Some coordination is definitely a good idea because electricity is one of those things where you've got to balance everything within the system at every second of every day. And so that balancing activity for the system as a whole is very important.
Regional planning has taken on urgency because Alaska needs new transmission lines. That will cost hundreds of millions of dollars at a time when the state doesn't have much extra cash to pay for it. So the cost will probably end up on Alaskans' electricity bills. For now, the state is letting the utilities try to work things out themselves. And at least two of them, Chugach Electric and Anchorage Municipal Light and Power, are seriously talking about teaming up within months and letting the other utilities join after that. This is Chugach Electric CEO Lee Thiebert.
You know, a year, I think, is really optimistic. It might take us 2 years, but I really do think that we can pull this together in pretty short order.
But some of the Rail Belt 6 power companies aren't thrilled about a new group of people looking over their shoulders, a group that could include renewable energy advocates like Chris Rose. Golden Valley Electric President Corey Borgeson from Fairbanks isn't comfortable rushing into a new way of doing things.
I called it a legacy project. You make a mistake, we're going to be living with it for a long time, and there could be very big dollars at stake.
One thing that might take some time? They need to hammer out how each power company gets paid for the electricity sent to someone else's territory. If all six companies can't settle this issue themselves, the state might step in to make sure electricity gets from power plants to teapots in the most affordable way.
Green? Is that okay?
Green would be great. Yeah. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A spokesman for U.S. Representative Don Young says the Alaska Republican is updating his financial disclosures to show ownership in a family farm dating to the 1990s and income from oil and gas leases. Spokesman Matt Shukaro says the failure to include the farm prior to his 2015 report was an oversight that became apparent after the death of Young's brother, Russell, and the property's sale. Shukaro says Young became a partial owner in the farm after his mother died in 1990, but Russell Young operated it. He says the congressman derived no income from farm operations, but did receive some income from oil and gas leases. He says income from leases in the 1990s was included in Young's congressional financial disclosures, but $4,100 over 3 years from a 2001 sale was not. He said the omission was inadvertent and Young's filings would be updated to reflect those. The story was first reported by the Alaska Dispatch News. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's new attorney general talks about tribal land into trust concerns for the state.
If these standards are met, then we can approve it. And if these, if these concerns are raised, then we will enter an objection.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaskans are passionate about salmon bringing communities, cultures, and economies together. Alaskans are standing up and declaring their lives are salmon lives. Visit salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A search continues for an overdue hiker in the hills surrounding Chena Hot Springs Resort. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says resort employee 19-year-old Anatoly Balko left on what he anticipated to be a two-day hike on Friday morning.
It was told to us that he left the resort at approximately 9:30 on Friday morning, and he was going to hike Far Mountain and back via the Charlie Dome area. It's about a 30-mile hike. He was supposed to be back at work on Sunday morning at 9 and did not show up.
Peter says troopers are part of a multi-agency search effort.
We're involved with Wilderness Search and Rescue, and we got our helicopter up, and we're working with the University of Fairbanks. They have a drone that's going to help us hopefully search the area.
Peter says Balko is thought to have a pink backpack and using a blue tarp for shelter. She asks anyone in the area to be on the lookout for him.
There's going to be a lot of people out there hunting, and so hopefully they can also be aware of the situation. So if they see a man out and about and looking like he needs a little help, he probably does.
Peters notes clear weather is aiding the search. It's uncertain what level of backcountry travel experience Balko has. The name of one victim in what appears to be a double homicide in Anchorage over the weekend has been identified. Police say 25-year-old Bryant DeHewson of Anchorage was one of the victims found dead early Sunday morning at Valley of the Moon Park. Police say they will release the name of the second victim after family notifications. Just before 2 a.m. on Sunday, Anchorage police received a call from a citizen stating they found a deceased person on the bike path at Valley of the Moon Park. Police arrived and found a male who appeared to be a victim of homicide. As police were searching the area, they found another deceased male victim nearby. This puts the number of violent deaths in the municipality at 26, just as many as took place in all of 2015, but with more than 4 months remaining in this year. Alaska's new Attorney General, Jana Lindemuth, is no stranger to litigation. Lindemuth has been practicing law in the state for nearly 20 years and has argued cases before the Alaska Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Lindemuth also represented clients pro bono, including one of the men known as the Fairbanks Four, helping to secure the release of the men after 18 years in prison. She says in private practice, she worked with a dozen clients at a time. Now she's managing a staff of 450, overseeing a big range of diverse legal issues. Lindemuth says the state's recent decision to drop the litigation against tribes being able to request the Interior Department to hold certain lands in trust status, effectively putting it under the protection of the federal government, should not be a cause for concern by Alaskans worried about what trust status could mean.
The federal government, the state, and then the ANCSA corporations, between those three groups, own more than 99% of the lands in Alaska. And so the less than 1% is in private hand or in tribal land. So like, there's just very little land right now that could even be at play for lands into trust. And so people need to keep that in perspective, right? And so these issues, I really look forward to working through these issues, but we shouldn't decide what it's going to look like until we've actually gotten there.
Well, kind of continuing on that theme, the applications for tribes in Alaska applying to have land placed into trust will be made public at some point. The state could challenge them on an individual basis. Has there been any conversation about what would rise to the level of concern where the state may say, not so sure we like this one?
So, you know, I've been tasked by the governor and the lieutenant governor to go out and engage with the different stakeholders. That includes the federal government, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it includes the tribes, it includes ANCSA corporations, it includes industry, it includes the Outdoor Council and those who are concerned with game management issues. It's everyone. What the end result may be could be potentially, you know, additional federal regulation that addresses the unique aspects of Alaska, or it could be that the state decides standards by which we will judge different applications that come up for trust status. So that would give us, you know, if these standards are met, then we can approve it. And if these concerns are raised, then we will enter an objection.
The state has had an evolving relationship with tribal courts. How is the relationship between those tribal courts and the state law department? How has that, I mean, you've only been there for weeks now, but what would you say the sort of trajectory of that relationship has been?
You know, there has been, even before I started, there's been a lot of collaboration and work on different agreements that would empower the tribal courts. There's civil diversion agreements, both in draft form with Tlingit Haida and with Tanana Chiefs, TCC. And those arrived on my desk with just a few more minor edits needed and to get those finalized. And so we're within probably a month or two of getting those agreements signed with both of those with both TCC and with Tlingit Haida. There's also the Kenaitse Wellness Court Initiative, and that's also on my desk, and we should be able to finalize that here soon. So those efforts were already begun and already well underway before I started, and I get to arrive and sign the paperwork and claim this as a victory.
How challenging will it be for you as the new leader of the state law department to manage all that's coming at you And in light of the fact that we've got less dough in the bank?
You know, Lori, it's extremely challenging. The state is facing a bunch of decisions ahead. And, you know, it's easy to say that folks that they want to cut government, but they have to realize that means cutting government services. Our budget overall in the last 3 years, the overall budget has shrunk 15%. And then the unrestricted general fund budget, which is the actual budget that I have control over, has shrunk almost 27%. Those are the funds that we use for child protection and to prosecute crimes. The department, before I even got there, has really had to rearrange things and to make sure that the most important issues are dealt with. But in the last 3 years, the crime rate, especially with the drug epidemic, has gone up. And so the demand on those attorneys has actually increased tremendously. For example, for child protection cases, the number of cases has gone up 50% in 2 years. So we're actually, it's not a matter of fewer lawyers dealing with the same workload. It's fewer lawyers dealing with a larger caseload.
That was Alaska's Attorney General, Jana Lindemuth.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. The 2016 Alaska State Fair will be completely smoke-free, protecting all fairgoers from exposure to tobacco smoke and the aerosol from electronic smoking devices. If you use tobacco or e-cigarettes, now is a great time to connect with Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line for free support, to set a quit date, and then breathe easy at the Alaska State Fair. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
In Wrangell, homebuyers can purchase a larger home for less money than other places in the region, but finding a place to buy is tough. As KSTK's Aaron Bolton reports, Wrangell has the lowest vacancy rate statewide, making it difficult for the Wrangell Medical Center to bring on new hires.
Wrangell Medical Center CEO Robert Rang has been on the job just a little over 10 months. When he started, the hospital had 8 nursing positions open. 6 of those positions have been filled, but he says lack of housing in Wrangell has made it extremely difficult.
Personally, I know of at least 3, you know, within just in the time that I've been here in the past year that declined to come on board just because of the availability of housing.
The hospital is applying for a $550,000 grant that would help fund building or buying housing for hospital staff. Rank hopes to build a 4-unit complex with 2 to 3 bedrooms each.
We have a lot of travelers, you know, professional staff, both on with the clinic that we work with them on, providers, as well as our nursing staff here. And so we have a need to rent through the community a lot of times to make sure that we have housing for those folks. What we've noticed is that there's times of the year and even during the winter that it's very difficult to find.
Rang says in particular, rentals larger than 1 bedroom are hard to come by, making it harder to hire staff with kids. But Wrangell's tight housing market isn't alone.
Housing is a particular problem across the region.
Melanie Shivens is the director of Raincoast Data and the economic development planner for the Southeast Conference. She says housing is a barrier across Southeast.
If you look especially at the communities of Juneau and Sitka and Skagway, there's such limited housing in those communities, and it's been such a barrier to entry for businesses coming in and for people moving in. And in those communities, the housing costs are even much higher.
Shivens gave a report on housing needs and issues in February, expressing the need for a potential housing development on the former Wrangell Institute site. She says Wrangell has a 0 to 1% vacancy rate for 1, 2, and 3 bedroom rentals, the lowest in the state.
And that survey is done in April, and so that's not even going into the summer. And in the summer, in Wrangell, you have a lot of summer needs for housing, for short-term housing with your fishing industry.
As for houses for sale, there were only 18 at the time of Shivens' report. At the hospital, 6 positions are still being filled by traveling staff until the new hires are fully trained and come on board. Rang told Wrangell's Borough Assembly Tuesday that the hospital spends over $50,000 to house traveling staff.
We've been spending a lot of money, taking a lot of resources out of the hospital that can be used for other things, for patient care and expansions and improvements.
As for staff that have accepted jobs, not all have found housing.
The ones that are arriving this month, yes, they have, but they have had some challenges. There is some concerns about the folks that are coming on board. They haven't really started looking yet, so I'm not sure exactly what they've been able to locate.
Rang hopes to solve that problem if the hospital is awarded the grant. He says it would work with the city to find a location. The hospital would also be able to purchase an existing building with that money. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Canadian mining company Constantine Metal Resources is in exploration for a potential mine north of Haynes and was recently granted BLM permission to expand the Palmer Project site. The plan includes building a couple of miles of road along with culverts and bridges to provide easier access to more drilling sites. An environmental analysis found that while the work will have some impacts on water and wildlife, it says the endeavor shouldn't cause significant harm. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
Right now, Constantine relies on a lot of this. The company uses a helicopter to shuttle employees and equipment to exploration sites along the mountain. Workers drill holes into the rock that average between 500 and 2,500 feet deep, looking for copper, zinc, gold, and silver. Liz Cornejo is Constantine's exploration and community manager.
There's a lot of activity going on in that area of the mountain, and it makes sense now to reestablish access to that area to better service those activities without the need for a helicopter for all operations.
Constantine had permission for up to 5 acres of ground disturbance. They now plan to build an access road that extends across Glacier Creek, up a mountain close to the main mineral deposit. That activity mandates an environmental assessment by the BLM. It took about a year to complete and garnered more than 200 public comments. Dennis Teitzel with the BLM oversees projects in the Haynes area.
It is our responsibility and goal to ensure that operations we permit on public lands are safe and protective of natural resources in the local community.
Teitzel says the plan met those standards. The environmental assessment acknowledges that the expansion will have some adverse impacts on the nearby Glacier Creek and wildlife, but the BLM determined that the potential effects are not significant. Guy Archibald with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council sees it differently. One of the conservation group's major worries is the road construction and other work around Glacier Creek could affect the rivers it flows into. The Klehini River and Chilkat River are important resources for subsistence and commercial salmon fishing. Here's Archibald.
And this is, you know, what we hope not to see above the Klehini River. There's too many communities and people and cultures that rely on healthy water and healthy fisheries up there.
One of Archibald's major concerns is that the road construction and other activity could strike rock that contains sulfide and cause acid rock drainage, harming water and wildlife. Constantines Cornejo says that's a risk they've evaluated and found to be unlikely.
All of the rocks in the area where that we're working for the road building will be non-acid generating.
The BLM also put an additional requirement in place to try to minimize the potential for acid rock generation. Constantine must have a geologist on site inspecting road work on a daily basis during construction for unanticipated exposures to sulfide minerals. Along with the road construction monitoring, the BLM lists a few other requirements. They include monitoring for raptor nests and mountain goats, and that the company provide a buffer to keep activity away from those areas. Constantine's exploration right now consists of drilling holes from the surface of the mountain. In the future, it could include underground exploration.
So at this point, it's something that is just something that we're evaluating but not yet proposing. And so it's important to look at our activities as they're currently proposed, which is just the road work to help support existing exploration activities.
Cornejo says every rock, soil, and water sample they take is to help evaluate the potential for a mine. They hope the newly approved road will help make that exploration easier and safer. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zechariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, and Emily Files in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Through photography, video, and stories, the Salmon Project celebrates the power of salmon and community. Visit salmonlife.org to experience Salmon Life stories from all across the state on Instagram and Facebook. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.